where he teaches environmental justice. We have Jay Austin, a senior lawyer at the Environmental Law Institute. We have Eric Lipton, an investigative reporter for the New York Times, and Jeff Holmstead, who is a partner at the law firm Bracewell in Washington, D.C. So a good place to start might be for us all to just chat a little bit about, maybe pick one thing that you think has a significant impact on public health, the environment, or the economy that the Trump administration is pursuing, and maybe it's something that you think is the most significant or something that is not quite getting enough attention. Barry, would you like to start for us?
Sure. I wanted to talk about the coal ash rule. But before I begin that conversation, that discussion, I was thinking about communities and the impact that deregulation has on communities. And so I thought about two quotations that I want to share with you. A first quotation, if you're not at the table, then you're on the menu. This is so true for communities because as a result of the Obama administration and the efforts there as far as enforcement was concerned, there was a lot of activity. There were opportunities to be engaged, to be involved in the environmental decision-making processes. But things have changed radically. And the fact of the matter is that if there is less enforcement in these communities, there's more pollution. That's the first quotation. The second quotation, I was trying to figure out how would you describe public policy and this administration's public policy as it relates to deregulation. So I thought about the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, and I want to share this quote with you. He said, on some questions, cowardice asks the question, is it expedient? And then expedience comes along and asks the question, is it politic? Vanity asks the question, is it popular? Conscience asks the question, is it right? Is it right? I thought about the Trump administration. I said, how would I describe the environmental policy? I thought about the op-ed piece that was submitted by a senior level person to describe what's happening in the Trump administration. There was a phrase that said, erratic and immoral. As a lawyer, I looked up the word immoral, and it says, lacking a moral sense, unconcerned with the rightness or wrongness of something. Now, we have this notion that the United States is the greatest nation on earth. Let's look at some of the policy. We're the greatest nation, but we have millions of small children who go to bed hungry every night because of our farm bill. Is that right? We say we're the greatest nation, but we turn away immigrants seeking refuge and separate nursing mothers from infants because of zero tolerance policy. And now we're moving forward with indefinite detention. Is that right?
No.
We're the greatest nation on this earth, but we're the only nation on earth that is not part of the Paris Climate Agreement because climate change is a Chinese hoax. Is that right?
No.
We're the greatest nation with the greatest EPA that excluded its own top science officials when it rewrote rules on using scientific studies. Is that right?
No.
It's a rhetorical question. So let's talk a minute about the coal ash rule. Well, we had some major coal ash spills over the years. One in 2008, the TVA's Kingston, Tennessee Valley fossil plant spill. 1.1 billion gallons of coal ash slurry was released. We have the Duke Energy Eden, North Carolina coal ash spill in 2014. 39,000 tons of toxic coal ash was released into the Dan River. So what did the Obama administration do? They came up with a final rule in 2015. They had about 500,000 public comments. They listened to communities. They listened to industry. They made significant changes. One of the most important was groundwater detection. The Trump administration, with this deregulation effort in 2018, said, no, we're going to do something entirely different. But in the meantime, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals issued a ruling in August 21st of this year, saying that the Obama administration didn't go far enough. They needed to do more. So I am wondering what the Trump administration will do. I'll stop there. I just wanted to set the table so that you can think about public policy and ask that question, is it right? And this effort at deregulation, is it the right thing to do under these circumstances?
We definitely will have a little bit of diverse perspective on what the Trump administration is doing here on the panel, and we'll get to that shortly. But Jay, what do you think is something that people should know about briefly that the Trump administration is pursuing?
Sure. Thanks, Emily. And I just want to thank SCJ for inviting me here today. I'm actually married to a journalist. My wife heard I was coming to this event, and that instantly gave me more credibility with her than anything else I'm doing all this year. So I appreciate that. To highlight just one thing, I would choose the attempts to repeal the Clean Water Rule, a so-called Waters of the United States, or WOTUS rule, which is the rule that defines the scope of federal protection over surface waters. It's something that I've followed for three decades of dueling Supreme Court opinions. It's very important, maybe second in importance only to the climate rules. People think of it as the wetlands rule because some of these cases, including ones that came up from Michigan, dealt with wetlands. But the thing to remember is that the rule is setting a single definition of U.S. waters for the entire Clean Water Act. So it's not just an esoteric debate about swamps and marshes. It also means industrial discharges into waterways. And once you start thinking about fluids, about liquid pollution and water and its tendency to flow, you can see the need for broad federal reach. The Obama-era EPA rule is based on reams of science. It was in response to a famously muddy opinion by Justice Kennedy, but also one by Justice Roberts, saying, hey, the agencies need to settle this. Something needs to be done. We can't have every case go to the Supreme Court. So that's what was put forth after a lot of study, public participation. And it will be interesting to watch what happens with that rule, which is currently tied up in litigation. And I think there's a huge burden on the current agency to, in its efforts to try to repeal and replace it, to make sure they've done their homework and come up with a credible job if they're going to supplant what was done previously.
Can we actually go to Jeff next? Can you tell us a little bit about what you do as well and your background at EPA under a previous administration and what you think has been a major impact, whether it's for the economy or for people?
Well, sure. Thank you very much for inviting me. My perspective is probably going to be a little bit different from some of the other people on the panel. I've worked on primarily Clean Air Act issues for almost 30 years, going back to the first Bush White House and the passage of the 1990 Clean Air Act amendments, and then in the second Bush administration, I was the head of the Air Office at EPA for about 5 years. In fact, I was head of that office longer than anyone else, including Gina McCarthy and her predecessors. I'm not here to defend everything the Trump administration is doing, but I will say this. Over the course of many years, the regulatory framework that applies to many of these companies has grown and grown and grown. And I will tell you from personal experience, both as a regulator and as someone who works with private industry, that some regulations work much better than others. And the thing that is unique about this administration is that we have, at least in some cases, people who are very knowledgeable, who are trying to do regulatory reform in a way that makes sense. And so we have people who's the head of the Air Office. We have Andy Wheeler now, who I think is a very thoughtful administrator, who are looking at ways to do sensible regulatory reform. We've already had some sense of this from other people up here, but so often that's painted as, you know, good and evil, and anything that's, you know, not tightening regulations is somehow bad. But I can tell you this, and I'd be willing to make this wager with anybody in the room, that at the end of this administration, whether it's a one-term or a two-term presidency, air quality will be better throughout the United States, water quality will be better throughout the United States, more lands will have been cleaned up, and yes, greenhouse gases will be lower than they were at the beginning. And that's for a whole bunch of reasons. But this idea that somehow the Trump administration is going to come in and be destructive to the environment, I think is... I will admit that in some cases the progress won't be as fast as it might have been under the Clinton administration, but the way our framework works will continue to guarantee environmental improvement. And I think the thing that's most notable about this EPA is they really are focused on reducing the burden of unnecessary regulations.
You think that's overall good for people?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, I mean... People need affordable energy. They need affordable products of all kinds. They need employment. All of those things are vital to having a healthy society, a healthy economy. And the things that are going on now, at least in the areas that I know about, are sensible regulatory reforms that are going to make it easier for people to protect the environment in more sensible ways. And the problem with this is we get into the details and it gets to be very esoteric and it's not very sexy to talk about, except to a few of us who really like this sort of thing. But I do think that's enormously important for the country, and I think it's a good thing.
So Eric is an investigative reporter with The Times, where he has a real knack for taking these esoteric details and making them sexy. Eric, what have you seen on the ground that... may look like it's been bad for people so far?
I'm going to actually pick up something that mm-hmm. Jeff works on really closely, and he's got quite a number of clients who help him, who pay him to pursue this issue, and this is new source review. Jeff.
Oh, I hope we can get into the details about new source
right.
review.
And I know Jeff loves this topic. He's testified about it, and he finds the new source review to be largely redundant and unnecessary. And he'll tell us that there are 17 different Clean Air Act rules that essentially have the same effect as new source review. And
Eric, can you just tell us briefly what that is for people who don't
sorry,
cover
yes.
air?
So new source review is a permitting program that protects air quality by requiring factories, boilers, and power plants that are going through modifications or that are being newly built to meet certain standards and to have the most advanced pollution controls required. Over the last 20 years, since the EPA began to use new source review as one of its most widely and frequently used enforcement tools, there have been 112 power plants in the United States with 342 different units. Because also often power plants have more than one power generating unit, that have gone through new source review enforcement that's resulted in $20 billion worth of new power pollution controls in those plants and $100 million worth of fines. That's just power plants. There's another $7 billion worth of upgrades that have occurred at 112 refineries in the United States and $116 billion worth of fines as a result of new source review. But Jeff Homestead and the folks at Bracewell, as well as Bill Wareham from Hunton, really don't like new source review, and neither do their clients, because they've paid this billions of dollars worth of upgrades. And so Bill Wareham, who was his counsel when Jeff was at the EPA and now runs the Air and Radiation Policy Shop, have been using their administrative powers to repeal key parts of new source review, even without doing rulemaking. And so through an accelerated process of simply issuing interpretations, they've been rolling back key parts of new source review. For example, DTE, all of you in your pockets have a DTE thumb drive that they handed to you. DTE is at the center of a huge court case, a court fight with the EPA that's been going on since 2010 over whether or not the EPA has the authority to second guess their projections of when they modify an old power plant and they upgrade it, are they going to increase emissions? And DTE has been suing the EPA over its belief that DTE violated the new source standards and didn't upgrade its plant. And in December, Bill Wareham's office, shortly after he came in, after he had worked for DTE and Hunton represented them, his office issued a policy of guidance that said, from now on, we're no longer going to second-guess the utility's estimations of increases in pollution coming from power plants that are going through retrofits. And it's not only relevant to power plants, but refineries and many other areas. So that was one of several major changes that are going on with respect to new source review. And the thing that differs, and I'm going to stop in a second, from like sort of the Clean Power Plan and even the waters of the U.S., is that this has already happened because these are administrative.
So are you going to take my bet?
Yeah.
I'll bet you 4 years from now,
right,
air pollution will be significantly better. So yeah. Much of what you're saying is really misleading, Eric, and you know that.
Okay.
You think they're looking for an invite to SEJ in 4 years?
No. Some of that's just outrageous. You know better than that. So you have a cap-and-trade program, right, that applies to all these utilities. So you tell me, when you go to the EPA website, and EPA, the part of EPA that looks at utility emissions, they tell you what's happened over the last 30 years. And they tell you what's responsible for those reductions. And what does it say?
They cite the new source review settlements.
No, they don't. They cite the acid rain program. They cite the NOx-SIP call. They cite the CARE rule. They cite the CASPER rule. Because when you have a cap-and-trade program, total emissions from the utility sector go down, and it has nothing to do with. So those settlements you're talking about, it may have reduced the cost to other utilities of complying with the cap and trade program, but they've had nothing. They don't do anything to reduce the overall cap. So they don't do anything to reduce the overall level of emissions that come from these plants.
Right, and Jeff has argued this in testimony, and Congress.
And I happen to be correct.
Right. Congress has the Republicans in the House, so far, have they acted on that bill in the House? The House subcommittee agrees with Jeff's position. But when I spoke with, I did a story about new source review. When I spoke with the enforcement people, the engineers at the EPA, and the lawyers who use new source review to
people
actually...
People who bring cases, not the people who actually reduce...
But the people who use new source review and consider it one of their most powerful and important enforcement tools, they told me that they feel as if this getting rid of, for example, second-guessing projections from the utilities is hugely consequential and is going to handicap their ability to determine whether or not retrofits are going to result in increases in emissions. And so, I mean, this is all a bit inside baseball, but it's actually quite consequential in terms of pollution in the United States. And I think that this is an example of something that has changed that potentially is going to result in an increase in pollution.
Okay, so you'll take my
thank you,
you'll
guys.
Take
I think
my bet.
We have a lot of ground to cover here, so just to give an idea of the scope, a lot of us cover very specific topics here, but there are several regulatory trackers you can look at. Harvard has one, Columbia has one that's great. The New York Times has one that shows that 76 major environmental regulations are being rolled back in one way or another. So I think one of the things we really want to make sure we talk about here is how much of this is going to stick. So there are clearly some things that there's a debate on that's very much on display in D.C. here about whether there's an impact right now. But there's also a question of, will the Trump administration have the time to get these rules through the court process? Will they be intact? So can we talk a little bit about, and Barry, I think you might have a little bit of a response, but then what the legal outlook seems to be in terms of how much time they have, most of these rules are proposed, to get them final, get them through the court process all the way potentially up to the Supreme Court for a lot of them. And what happens if a different president comes in and has a different agenda?
Well, remember the case that I talked to you about that was decided by the D.C. Circuit August 21st of 2018. They were looking at the Obama rule.
And sorry, you're talking about coal ash, Barry?
Coal ash rule, I'm sorry. And so now the Trump administration came up with their final rule in, I believe it was April of this year. So how is the court and when is the court going to deal with this particular issue? How are they going to address the stresses and strain within that rule and how is it going to impact people? But I think Jeff is right. We do need electricity. I live in Puerto Rico, and there's this facility called the Applied Energy System Facility that supplies 70% of the electricity for the island of Puerto Rico. Now, they had a 5-foot story collection of coal ash. Now, what happens is that when you have an unlined lagoon, that coal ash seeps into the groundwater. Now, what happens is that people who live on wells, they use the groundwater in order to survive. There's a community, there's a city, Guayama, Puerto Rico, where this facility is at. Now, all of the people, so many of the people have cancer. Young people are dying of cancer. There was just an article about that about 2 weeks ago. I hope to write a book about that. Yes, you do need electricity, but at what cost? Who is going to be impacted? These local communities where people are dying on a daily basis. That's the reality of these rules.
Jay, what about the remaking of the courts? We've seen a lot of new judges come in. We're looking at another Supreme Court nominee. I'm not checking my phone. Something could have happened on that or, you know, in regulatory news since we've been up here, but there's a lot of change. So what do you think that might mean long-term for whether some of these major rules survive, including the one that you talked about, the water rule?
Well, it's definitely a piece of the puzzle, which is why you see such pitched battles over who makes it to the courts. I mean, we're talking about the pinnacle right now this week with the Supreme Court, but in the interim, there have been any number of appointments to the courts that really matter to environmental law, the circuit courts of appeals, including the D.C. Circuit, often called the second most important court in the country. And yes, who those judges are, what ideologies they may bring with them, leaving aside political party or who appointed them, I'm talking about specific ideologies, can definitely affect the outcome. The question of how much leeway agencies get to make their own rules, whether judges defer under the so-called Chevron doctrine to agencies' judgments and interpretations of law is very important. If judges are inclined to go beyond that, that can affect the outcome. Judge Kavanaugh is someone who's very much on the record as looking for a strong statement from Congress before agencies are allowed to do things. If he doesn't find that, he's less inclined to give leeway to the agency's interpretations, and that could easily affect something like the water rule, where you have to keep in mind none of these statutes have been amended since about 1990. So the agencies are often working with old statutory texts. They're trying to apply it to current situations. That leaves room for interpretation, and then it's just a question of how strict or how liberal a judge is going to be in allowing that.
What have the judges said so far? Maybe you and Eric could both talk about some of the setbacks they've seen from the courts.
Well, you've seen a whole first wave of decisions. I would characterize those as mainly procedural. One of the things this administration did that I think was unprecedented was make broad use of procedural stays and delays of Obama-era rules, trying to prevent existing rules from going into effect or being implemented, trying to suspend or pull back on rules that were in effect. And what you're seeing is any number of decisions in the courts saying, you know, that's not normal. You can't do that, at least not in the way or the pace that it was done. There were any number of mechanisms that were tried for doing this, some of them under specific statutes, some of them using rulemaking, some of them through petitions to courts where litigation was already ongoing with these rules. But in any number of ways, the courts are saying there may not be a legal basis for certain delay, or you can't do things like suspend an existing rule without also allowing some discussion of what it is that you plan to replace it with. That's what happened in the case of the water rule that I was discussing. It's also, you've seen some of these decisions across the board, though. They've come up in the context of the methane rules, the chemical safety rule, and other areas. But I'd call that the first wave, and it's largely based on procedure and whether or not you can stop the clock while you're putting your own rules
in
place.
So we shouldn't judge based on that, how the outcomes will be of other...
Well, it certainly shows that certain types of haste, which are perhaps more characteristic of the previous EPA administrator than the current administrator, certain types of haste, certain ways of doing things without crossing the T's and dotting all the I's is not going to fly. And that same kind of scrutiny will apply maybe even more so to the substantive rules. Once those go into effect and are challenged in the courts, it's not just a question, did you go through the right procedure, but did you also do the homework, the science, the public comment that goes into crafting a true replacement rule?
Eric, would you like to talk about that process?
Yeah. I mean, just to give a short version of what Jay was saying is that, I mean, again and again, the Pruitt has been was told that his actions were arbitrary and capricious, that you can't simply suspend rules for, and you can't violate the Administrative Procedures Act. And so so many of the things that they did in the first year and a half were these suspensions without... But the thing, the shift that's going on right now is we're now moving into the real rulemaking with the ACE and we're because we're 2 years in, they did all of these suspensions. Almost all of the suspensions have been thrown out as being arbitrary and capricious, and it was sloppy work. I mean, even OIRA, the office at the White House that is supposed to oversee, you know, the federal rulemaking, was sort of saying on the sides to us reporters that this was sloppy, that they did so many things in essentially an illegal way. And it was, you know, it was surprising. It was part of what Pruitt, the things that Pruitt did that, that expressed that he was sloppy in ethically and in his execution. And so, but we're now, we shifted into a different era where now they're actually going into the rulemaking. And that's where the court challenges are really going to be interesting. With ACE, the replacement for Clean Power Plan being the first.
So I want to take the advantage of the opportunity to agree with Eric and others that this administration is, look, it's different from any administration we've seen in our lifetimes, and I'm older than probably everybody else here.
Closer.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
They didn't have as part of the campaign people who were subject matter experts on any of these things, and so they didn't have people who were ready to step in and take these positions. And so Scott Pruitt was appointed, and the people who came in with him had essentially no experience on administrative procedures or on the substance of environmental law. The other problem they have is they came in with this distrust of the EPA staff, and so they did some things that were just terribly sloppy. And I know career folks at OIRA who thought the same thing. They couldn't believe that EPA was sending over these rules for review. So I think that's absolutely right. But I also think Eric is right. They finally got people in place who actually are thoughtful, who understand more of these issues. And I think the real test is going to come a year from now when we start seeing some of the major rulemakings. But yeah, their track record so far hasn't been very good. But I think what that is largely sort of the sloppiness and the lack of experience that they had in the first year that they were in office.
So we could go on and on about all the rollbacks that a lot of us do cover. But Jeff, I think it's important to talk a little bit about the rationale here. You speak frequently with officials at EPA. You work for Republican EPA. 76 rollbacks, at least, according to the Times. What was wrong with all of them? Why did so many things need addressing in their point of view? Why this scale? And do you think that's normal to go from one administration to another to have this much change?
No, we've never seen, although it's partly the nature of the Obama administration. Whether you think it's a good thing or a bad thing, they were remarkably productive in getting rules through the process. And they did some very aggressive rules. The Clean Power Plan, probably the most prominent among them. And so there's certainly people like me who thought some of those things really were regulatory overreach in a way that we had not seen before. And now we're seeing the pendulum swing back pretty far to the other direction. So I think it's not possible to look in isolation at this administration without sort of reviewing what happened under the prior administration. So you have disagreements on policy. You see on some of these things, in particular, say the Clean Power Plan, where there are many of us, including probably 4 current members of the Supreme Court and 5 members of the old Supreme Court, who thought that EPA had gone well beyond its statutory authority. So you know, in that area, a lot of these regulatory reforms are designed to sort of put EPA back in its lane. And I hope we get a chance to talk maybe a little bit more about the Clean Power Plan. But
Jeff, if I can, though, if legal authority and legal interpretations are the issue, then why not let the court sort it out? I mean, your clients took the extraordinary step of going to the Supreme Court for a stay of the Clean Power Plan while it was still pending at the D.C. Circuit. One of Justice Scalia's last actions was the casting and deciding vote there. Further took the steps once the administration was in place and the issues were teed up before the D.C. Circuit, 8 hours of argument or whatever it was, and ready to be decided on basically the same claims you're making now as to why there isn't authority. Why not let the courts decide if it's legal interpretation?
Well, for several reasons. One is simply that, you know, people ask me all the time whether this is legal or that's legal under the Clean Air Act. And ultimately what it comes down to, unfortunately, is how many votes you have on the D.C. Circuit and how many votes you have on the Supreme Court. I think this administration, in particular on the Clean Power Plan, wanted to have the opportunity to have the court review its interpretation of the statute. And given the way the oral argument went, I think probably a lot of people thought that the D.C. Circuit would have upheld the Clean Power Plan. That doesn't mean that it's legal, because it almost certainly would have gone up to the Supreme Court, and this administration wanted to have the opportunity to interpret the Clean Air Act in a way that they thought would withstand judicial scrutiny. And I think ultimately, you know, we talk about all these cases are going to go to the Supreme Court. That's just not true. The Supreme Court may take a handful of environmental cases, but I think that's one that they probably will take.
With Jeff on the point about the Obama administration, and one of the reasons that we're seeing such an incredible number of rollbacks during the Trump administration is not just that the activist nature of the Trump folks, and that is, you know, the deconstruction of the administrative state, as Bannon famously said early in the start of the Trump administration, but it's just that Obama himself repeatedly in the second term was saying, I have the power, you know, the power of the pen. And I have my phone and my pen, and he was so frustrated with Congress after they couldn't get cap and trade passed that he decided that he was going to use his executive power. And he used it to such an extreme that he helped, as I wrote at one point, and it got the liberals so mad that people claimed they were going to cut off their subscriptions in the New York Times. But to some extent, the hubris of the Obama administration, to the extent to which it used its executive powers to enact so many regulations in the environmental sector, to some extent, you know, it was part of the backlash, you know, that resulted. I mean, it's part of the reason even Trump got elected. It's part of the reason that the EPA is so aggressively rolling back the rules. So I think part of the reason that so many rules are being rolled back is that the Obama administration was so aggressive in its use of its executive regulatory powers. And there were so many things that were pushed through in the second term after they essentially felt that they could not do it through Congress, that they were just going to use the power of the pen. And in fact, Obama, you know, he quite openly said, this is what we're doing. You know, forget about Congress. We're going to do it ourselves.
I think Jay has something to say here. But just for a moment, if you can start getting your questions ready for reporters and SEJ members, there are two microphones you can start lining up at, and we'll probably go to those in the next few minutes here. But I want to make sure that we aren't losing track of one of the key parts of the discussion here, and maybe Jay can go into this after responding, but the impacts on people and what Barry teaches about environmental justice. So it's one thing to go back and forth on statute and whether they're allowed to do this and how they're allowed to do this, but the fact remains that at the end of the administration, like, it's very likely this is all still unsettled for another however long it takes to get settled by a future administration. What happens to people in the meantime? And Jay, if you had a response first.
Well, I just want to pick up on Eric's point. I think when talking about executive power, it's important to distinguish between two kinds. I mean, one is executive orders, and that's what's famously known as doing things with the stroke of a pen. I feel like that doesn't really go very far at all in the environmental law field. It can be done for show, as this administration's been doing. But if you look at the Obama administration actions, there's very little that was done purely by executive order. The social cost of carbon is one example, White House initiative to put a price on carbon emissions. But everything else is through the much more complicated level of agency rulemaking, which is the process of agencies looking at their statutory authority given by Congress through the administrative process with public input and a prescribed public procedure. And then ultimately, as we've discussed, getting reviewed by the courts. So all the branches are involved in that. The fact that an administration, any administration, is using that tool right up to the last hours. I mean, the talk of midnight rules is always misleading because, as everyone knows, it takes years to prepare and to publish these things. You know, that's a little misleading. So, I mean, I don't know that that's any less legitimate. The area where the Obama administration was most criticized for using his executive authority was immigration, was DACA, where there really were some questions about the legitimacy of doing things by executive order, and then some of those things get wiped away by executive order, or at least attempted to, as we've seen.
I'd like to come back to Barry for a second, and then we'll go to questions here. But we mentioned the Clean Power Plan, the Obama administration's rule that would have sped a shift away from coal use and electricity. So what EPA is doing now is they're looking at not considering the co-benefits for air pollution. So they want to look only at the domestic impacts on climate change, and they don't want to consider how much cleaner the air could be, you know, below thresholds already set in other rules. So, and Barry, I know you were talking a little bit more about coal ash than air regulations, but what do things like that mean for people, especially when you're teaching your students about sort of cumulative impacts, right? Because these rules don't have equal impact on every person in the country. Some people live in places that are next to a highway, next to a coal plant, next to an industrial facility. They don't have clean water, and they're pretty poor. So what does that mean for people?
Well, the problem with cumulative impacts is that if you're a community living next to a facility in other industries that have permits, a permit is a license to pollute. And so if you're living in that kind of situation and you're bombarded with all of these things that are confronting you on a daily basis and your public health is being impacted, how do you determine which facility is responsible for your illness? That's where cumulative impacts really has problems, because you cannot prove it in court. You just don't know. It's a toxic soup. And the people in Puerto Rico that I talked about, I mean, what about other communities across the island where their landfills have been accepting this coal ash? They're very poor, the people living next to these landfills. Are they going to be impacted by the coal ash in that particular landfill? And I must say that disposing of coal ash throughout Puerto Rico was banned last year because it's been so bad. But how do you make that determination when people are suffering from so many other ailments, if you will, or so many other sources? That's a real problem.
We're going to save a good solid 20 minutes here for questions. I just want Eric to follow up a little bit. Can you pick one of your stories to tell us about, maybe pesticides, where you've seen what the impacts could be like on the ground for people from one regulation change?
Sure. I mean, that's an example of something that, if it were not for the Trump administration, chlorpyrifos, which is a widely used pesticide, in particularly in California, on all kinds of fruits and vegetables, almonds, and broccoli, chlorpyrifos would no longer be in commercial use in the United States right now. The EPA scientists concluded that it was sufficient evidence that it was causing developmental disabilities among farm worker children. It's a neurotoxin, and there was accumulative amounts in the bloodstreams of women who were pregnant, and the IQ levels of children was, through epidemiological studies, were found to be lower. And the EPA had sufficient evidence to recommend that chlorpyrifos should be removed from the market. In March of 2017, Pruitt signed an order repealing that proposed ban on chlorpyrifos. And we got through Freedom of Information requests and interviews, we were able to determine that the head staffers were essentially ordered to reverse their position after the pesticide industry appealed to Pruitt and said that this was too important of a product for the farmers and for the industry, and they didn't want it removed from the marketplace. Right now, actually, even, you know, a court, just as we were talking about, the court has ruled that the EPA has 60 days to remove chlorpyrifos from the market, even though Pruitt ignored his own staff recommendation, and the EPA is still appealing that. But that's an example of something that really this is changed. I mean, the enforcement in general, the enforcement program at the EPA has been significantly diminished the amount of enforcement actions. The EPA argues that is them delegating authority to the states, and the states are therefore picking up the work that the regional offices had done. But I think that they're out across the United States. If you look deeply enough, you would find evidence of notices of violation that have not resulted in enforcement. as a result of a significant decline in enforcement activity by the EPA. So there's lots of examples of things that are happening and are making real changes. Now, whether or not whether or not that means that the air pollution and water pollution is cumulatively getting worse in the United States, I don't know. And we won't know, and maybe it won't. But are there places, you know, in narrow windows across the environment where there are changes occurring? I think there are.
So, Eric, you would say don't look just at regulatory rollbacks. Look at other things the agency is doing and changes to policy, enforcement, staffing.
Yes.
Okay. And so questions from reporters and SEJ members. Please introduce yourself, your name, and your affiliation. I think this gentleman over here was first. And please speak very close to the microphone.
Musician, so I know how to do that.
Okay.
Andy Revkin, former New York Times, National Geographic. Great discussion. But you didn't really get at something that's probably the hardest story to get at. And I'd like to find out if there's a way, maybe Eric, if you know there's a way to write this story. And this is for the room, too. So much of what that debate between Eric and Jeff was about the existing rule book, which hasn't really changed. And you're going to have this whiplash, administrative whiplash, every time there's a cycle in the White House. If you look systemically, it goes back to Congress and how Congress works and how it's broken. And that's why what was said about immigration policy is the same. You know, boom, here we go, this way, whiplash, whiplash. So if we're not going to take the ball back to writing about Congress and how, if you want any progress other than through this completely broken court system and enforcement system, which is never going to be what it was. EPA is shrinking, it's aging, it was shrinking under Obama. The capacity to do that isn't in the future, but there's lots of capacity to answer Eric's question. Are we getting cleaner or dirtier? That's easy to answer. The data are there. It's open data. So what is anyone examining that bigger story? Like, how do we actually move away from having the whole argument play out under this existing brittle, paralyzed framework?
Fantastic question. I will say from my perspective as a Washington, D.C. reporter, it's really hard to write about things that aren't happening. It's a lot easier to write about things that are. And also going up to Congress and posing a climate change question to anyone up there right now, very difficult, especially if it's like Lisa Murkowski, a little difficult to get in there. But Eric, I mean, do you write about that kind of step back? Like, do we even have the right framework here to address these problems? I mean, I don't think that Congress is looking at opening up any of these laws.
I mean, I think that the biggest change comes about when industry and the government are in agreement that something has to happen. And so, for example, I mean, the extent to which methane emissions should be reduced from oil and gas production, you know, how much the company should have to spend to reduce methane is a subject of some debate, and the EPA's methane rule and the BLM's methane rule have both been, you know, in the process of being repealed by the Trump administration. But even the industry agrees that they need to do more to reduce methane leaks, and they are moving in that direction. And so, you know, you get the most, you know, progress when industry embraces. And the thing that most confounding to me with the Trump administration is when they do things that it's like you wonder, who's the constituency? You know, like, for example, with the glider truck rule, in which they, if you follow that at all, when Pruitt allowed a loophole that would allow the significant expansion in the number of these trucks that don't have modern emissions controls, you sort of wonder, well, what, you know, the United States, going back to the Bush administration, has spent, you know, so much time and effort to try to reduce diesel emissions from diesel, you know, tractor trailers. Why would they roll that back? You know, the industry has embraced it. UPS wants it, you know. And that's the thing I don't understand. So I guess my answer to that question is you get progress when industry and the government embrace it. And to some extent, I think that's where we were with the Clean Power Plan, when the big utilities embraced the Clean Power Plan, but now we're rolling it back.
Well, the utilities, many of the utilities embraced it, but the coal companies did not, certainly.
See, and with the coal ash rule, for example, there were 500,000 public comments. Communities and industry were involved in the development of the rules that was put into place in 2015. But then they went to court because the environmentalists said, well, the Obama administration didn't go far enough. The industry people said they went too far. The D.C. Circuit agreed with the environmentalists. So we're going to have to see what the courts are going to say about the Trump administration and their final rule, whether or not that's the D.C. Circuit or the Supreme Court. We wait to see what's going to happen. Nobody has a crystal ball. If you do have a crystal ball right now, it's very, very cloudy. Very cloudy. So we'll just have to wait and see and listen to what's being said. But sometimes when industry and the government come together, that doesn't mean that it's going to last, and it's going to last forever.
You have some industry talking about a carbon price in D.C., but that doesn't mean that that legislation is moving.
This is an issue that probably all of us have thought a lot about, but I'll make two observations. I do think for all kinds of issues, it's probably more productive to have at least one House of Congress be in the opposite party from the White House. It really does force more discussion. And so, I mean, we can talk about Waxman-Markey and sort of the early efforts in the Obama years, but I think in some ways that was undone by the fact that there were Democrats in both houses, and there wasn't the kind of compromise that could have gotten that across the finish line. The other thing I will say is, we could talk about this a long time, and Andy, I'd love to talk with you more about this too, but I think the only way we get progress on a big issue like climate change is with White House leadership. And people say, well, Obama, you know, he supported Waxman-Markey, certainly true, he gave speeches about it, but you go back to the 1990 Clean Air Act amendments, which really is the last major piece of environmental legislation. President George H.W. Bush campaigned in part on wanting to be the environmental president, and they were actually, and I was a junior staffer in the White House, and I thought this was the way things always worked. It turns out that it's never worked that way since, but you actually had sort of six senior White House officials who every day were involved in negotiating with Congress over the Clean Air Act. And the administration actually put together its bill. They didn't say, you know, go work on something. They said, here is what we could support. And that served as sort of the starting point for negotiations. And so you had the administration that was meeting with industry folks. And I can tell you one thing that the Bush administration did is when they thought industry was being unreasonable, they pushed back on sort of their own constituency. And so there were times when they said, you know, we understand you're taking this position on the NAPAP tons. Our analysis just shows you're wrong. So we're not going to support you on that. So I think you need that kind of White House leadership. And part of the problem we have on these issues is as much as we care about them, they don't seem to rise to the top politically when you ask people what they care about. And on climate change, that's especially surprising. It's always, you know, kind of near the bottom of the list when you ask people what they care about. But I do think it's still possible, but I think it's only possible if you have, you know, White House leadership, meaning real involvement in at every step of the way.
Over here in the red scarf.
Mm-hmm. Hi.
And your name and title, please.
My name's Emily Gertz.
We can't quite hear you.
Better?
A little bit?
Okay. My name's...
Perfect.
My name's Emily Gertz. I'm a freelance environmental journalist, and I publish a newsletter called Deregulation Nation. One action taken at EPA that hasn't been mentioned yet is the attempt to sort of sever sound epidemiological science from the rulemaking process through this so-called transparency, scientific transparency measure. I wonder what those of you on the stage, what chance you give that measure of going all the way to enactment, and what, if anything, could be done to reverse that in a future administration or a future Congress. Thank you.
If I can ask to keep, I want to make sure we get through all our questions. Yeah. So brief here, but very important question.
I think that the Pruitt was much more enthusiastic about this, the secret science and the fake science whole, dogma. And I think it's going to be a test of Wheeler as to whether how aggressively he pursues that. And the House just had another hearing on it this week, and I almost felt like that House hearing might have been a sign that there was some weakening backbone within the EPA in the sense that they needed to, you know, stir things up a little bit and try to get it moving again. There's an enormous amount of lobbying money behind that because the industry, the short version is if you can undermine the science and you can stop collecting the data, then you're going to slow down the rulemaking. And the chlorpyrifos decision was an example of that. They attempted to undermine the science. So as to whether or not that's going to survive, that's a real key test of Wheeler, and I'm watching and will be interested in see how it plays out.
And just to recap, if anyone isn't familiar, so the policy essentially would be that they only take into account science that's reproducible and that they can publish the individual data. So for a study of a lot of people, that might mean publishing health data, which you're not allowed to do. It just gets very complicated very quickly.
Well, using somewhat non-standard definitions of what reproducible and transparent are, not consistent with previous use in the scientific community.
Hi, can you hear me? This is Reed Frazier. I'm a public radio reporter in Pittsburgh. I work for the Allegheny Front and State Impact Pennsylvania and NPR affiliate shows. I also run a podcast or help run a podcast called Trump on Earth. Emily and Jeff have both been on it. So this question is kind of basically for Jeff, but anybody else can comment. I want to ask about the mercury rule. And I just read in the New York Times a few weeks ago that the administration is thinking about rolling it back. The question I have is, so a little background about the mercury rule is that it was implemented many years ago. It was litigated, and as it was getting litigated, all these coal-fired power plants basically decided to shut down rather than comply. Others spent billions of dollars to comply with this rule. It went on the books eventually. And so my question is, why are these, if the coal industry has already kind of complied with the rule, and it's, you know, I visited one of these plants where they spent $750 million to put in these scrubbers to comply. Why are they rolling it back? I mean, it's sort of like, what purpose does it serve? It's sort of like, what's the constituency for it? Jeff,
does it have something more to do with the rule's underlying legal foundation?
Yes. So there's been, not to be too critical of the New York Times, but I don't think they got it right. The administration is actually not talking about changing any of the requirements of the MATS rule. And this, again, is very complicated. Unless you are really an environmental lawyer, this may not even be interesting to you. But before the Obama administration could finalize that rule, there had to be a regulatory finding that we call the appropriate and necessary finding. And I'm not going to go through chapter and verse, but there was this legal finding that where they basically said the costs and we look at the cost and the benefits, and we think even though it's going to be very costly, we think this rule is justified. And it's more complicated than that because originally the Obama administration didn't even look at the costs, and they went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said they had to take into account the costs. But that finding is separate from the rule. So that was a finding that had to be made. And then after that, they did the MATS rule. You're absolutely right that everybody in the industry has already complied. And I can tell you, and I think this is also a matter of public knowledge, the utility community and most coal companies have actually lobbied EPA not to change the MATS rule. It would be very disruptive. And so there isn't a constituency to change the rule, but there's a great deal of controversy over the underlying finding. That's what they're proposing to revisit, is that finding. And what people don't understand is, let's say that finding goes away, that doesn't undermine the rule in any way because of another D.C. Circuit opinion.
Jeff,
so the bottom line is the MAT, they are going to do something on MAT that has to do with this regulatory finding. We can talk about co-benefits and other things, but in terms of the requirements that apply to individual coal-fired power plants, they're not going to be changing.
And this is a really critical thing to understand because so much of the regulations, part of the argument for them is that the Trump administration says the Obama administration underestimated the cost and overcounted the benefits because they're looking at different benefits. Like I was talking about with the Clean Power Plan, they're saying you should only consider what this regulation meant to do, not the other things that it also would have done. And that is one of the things that is at play with the mercury rule as well. Briefly, if you can give your question, and maybe one person can take it, and then we'll do a wrap-up question here.
I hope all will answer.
And your name and title, please.
Sure. My name is Rich Blousy, freelance environmental journalist. I have a law background. So Mr. Homestead said, I hope we'll bring up the Green Power Plan. So this ties in with the 2007 case, Massachusetts versus EPA. Justice Stevens issued the decision. Justice Kennedy was the swing vote. There was the finding that greenhouse gases are a pollution, and it's within the ambit of the Clean Air Act. So for Mr. Homestead, do you support that finding, and do you say this current administration supports that decision, and there will not be an effort in the legal community to reverse it?
Jeff, could you hear all that?
I think I understood the question.
Mass EPA, which is essentially what obligates EPA to address climate change.
Right.
Does EPA accept that they have that obligation, or will they challenge that?
No, but not just the EPA, the legal advisors to the Trump administration, okay, too. Do they support that? Will there be an attempt to reverse it?
As far as I know, and I talk to people fairly often, there's no one within the administration that has any interest in trying to reverse that finding.
And so that's why they're writing a replacement to the Clean Power Plan, because
right,
they are acknowledging that there is a requirement to address climate change. They're just saying, we think we're far more limited by statute than the Obama administration.
Right. The controversy is not over. EPA accepts, and this administration accepts, that it needs to regulate greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act. The question is how they do that, how they use those authority, what that authority allows them to do. But no one, and especially now that Administrator Pruitt is gone, no one is talking about reversing the so-called endangerment finding.
And there was discussion of that early on with Scott Pruitt. There was consideration of not writing a replacement to the Clean Power Plan, and it became very clear that industry wanted a replacement. So if we can do a little bit of a lightning round here, could each of you maybe in a sentence say what you think reporters here should be paying attention to? Where are we headed? What's next?
Oh.
Jay, you can have two sentences. How about that? I know you have a lot on your mind. No? Or
well, I think that one thing that should be done is to talk about incorporating morality into public policy. If that can be done, I think the results will be better in the long run for everyone concerned, not only industry, but also communities, also policymakers. As I said very early in my opening statement, is it right? If you can answer that question in a way that's positive, well, then move forward with whatever it is that you're going to do.
I would say keep your eye on the upcoming battle royale over tailpipe emissions and the possibility of revoking the California waiver. I think the thing that most bothers me about the substance of these rollbacks, and this is across the board, not just at EPA, but also at Department of Interior, Department of Energy, elsewhere, is this very transactional mindset. As in so many other areas, existing rules are looked at as deals. The deals are presumed to be bad, particularly if they came from the previous administration, and therefore the solution is to blow them up and start over again. So if you consider a 50-year history of California having its own authority to regulate tailpipe emissions, if you consider that it was a settled deal with the manufacturers and others, and now this is being unwound, I guess in this metaphor, California is being treated like Mexico or possibly even North Korea. So it will be as big a battle, hopefully still a diplomatic one.
And Eric,
maybe nuclear.
Go ahead and tell us what your next big scoop is.
But I think that the courts is where it's all at, and it's not just today with the Supreme Court, but the Court of Appeals. And I mean, the one thing that the Trump administration, beyond the regulatory rollbacks that it has been incredibly efficient at, is filling vacancies in the federal, you know, appeals courts. And it's a generational change that's going on. They had all of these vacancies they came in with, and the Federalist Society and you know the Council of Domagam has been very efficient at filling those seats. And all the things we're talking about will ultimately largely be decided by the courts. And so I just think that's where so much of this is going to play out. And the court, who he's nominating for the courts is so consequential for the next, 20, 30 years, 40 years of environmental policy in the United States.
So I would agree. I think the most interesting stories in the next couple of years are going to be coming out of the courts. I would point out that on the D.C. Circuit, which is the most important circuit in terms of EPA regulations, there is and there will be a majority of Democratic appointees on that court just by virtue of the numbers. And they're going to be making decisions on Obama rules, and I think you're right. We're going to go through the rulemaking process. We're going to see how those stand up in court, and that's really the thing to watch.
Well, I'm sure everyone here would love to chat with folks after if you want to approach us individually, and thank you so much for all of your expertise.